the Rink, your weekly source for hockey talk without the entitlement. I'm James Chapelet Graylian, along with Tom Luongo. This week, Gary Bettman gave a State of the Game address. As you can imagine, Tom and I have some thoughts of our own. The Dallas Stars and the Montreal Canadiens make a couple announcements. Some of the news that isn't, and of course, the Stanley Cup Finals. It's all coming up on the Rink. Tom, I am a damn dirty liar, and I'm going to tell you why. I have actually seen probably 5/6 of the Stanley Cup Finals so far. I think I missed about a period worth, and I feel dirty. Didn't we say that we weren't going to watch the finals because we really weren't that interested?
Well, at least one of us isn't a liar.
Well, I'm okay with being a liar.
I actually caught 5/6 of a minute of period three of game one, and watched Justin Applicator score and make it 3-1, and I went, oh, look, game's over, and went back to watching something else with my wife.
I think I think it's funny that nobody really even knows how to pronounce his name necessarily. I mean, I know that that was probably it, but I mean, all I'm seeing is Abdicator, Abracadabra, Applecrater, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think it is actually Abdulkader, A-B-D-A-L. So I think it's Abdulkader.
It's a new star of the league, I guess, because he's and that was the one where he caught his own, caught the rebound and jammed in. I mean, it was the
great
best
goal.
Yeah, it was the best goal of the first game, especially considering that Marc-Andre Fleury should have gotten one of the stars for the Red Wings, knocking in two goals, especially that first one.
Right.
I think that the best thing that Marc-Andre Fleury did in that entire game, I mean, he had a couple of good goals, but wasn't falling coming out of the gate. That's about the best thing, unlike last year.
No, yeah, the applicator goal was great, because it was I think I enjoyed more than anything else watching Jordan Staal just stand there lost.
Yeah, he was absolutely lost.
It was great. Ridiculous. I was like, I watched the replay, I'm like, dude, at least move your head and look for the puck. He's just standing there like nothing's happening there. You know, puck up, drops it down to a stick, bats it by the goaltender, goal 3-0. I'm like, I'm done. I can't win. No, I'm sorry.
I think if anything I'm learning about Jordan Staal, it's that he's a good hockey player when the puck's in front of him and he knows where the puck is. But once it gets in his feet, nearby, to the side, behind him, he just kind of loses what to do. And it's sad because, you know, I mean, if anybody who plays the game has been in that position where you're just searching for it and you just don't know where it is and you don't know which way to turn.
Right.
And he seems to have an inordinate amount of moments like that.
I never really know. I haven't really noticed personally, but I'll take your word for it. You know.
It just seems that way with him. But you know, then again, like, I mean, I was a huge I was bad mouthing Brett Clark, defenseman for the Avalanche, for a long time, because it seemed like every time I turned on I turned into the game, he would be, you know, making some mistake that would let the puck go by him and into the Avs net, and you know, and while everybody else was singing his praises, I'm going, what? Is it just my timing? Is that what's doing it? But yeah,
maybe it's that goal by Applicator the other night reminded me so much of Game 7 against Carolina in 2006. That knocked us out. There's Rory Fitzpatrick looking for the puck, and it's right between his feet, and everybody in Buffalo, the greater, you know, Western New York area, is screaming, "Look down!" And Rod Brindamore pokes the puck, you know, between his feet, and past Ryan Miller, and that was the game. And you just knew it was the game at that point. And but you know. It is what it is.
Yeah. Now it's and of course the nice thing for the Penguins is that they actually scored in the first two games this year, unlike last year where they were shut out in the first two.
Right.
But certainly not enough. The most controversy. It's nice to see that there are not a lot of calls, and in general it seems like pretty clean hockey. Overall, but obviously the most controversy being the end of the second period with Evgeny Malkin going all Alexander Semin and getting an instigator called against him, which of course in the as the NHL always does, decided to rescind the automatic suspension.
Yeah, it was 18 seconds left at the end of game two. He and Henrik Zetterberg got into it. Mm-hmm. I caught the YouTube of that. But yeah, I think it was, I was watching something with Pierre LeBrun and Scott Burnside at ESPN.com just before we went live. And it was, you know, Burnside was like, well, it's not like you could be surprised about this when Scott Walker didn't get suspended for pretty much sucker punching Aaron Ward. Mm-hmm. No one was going to get, you know, suspended. So no one's really, I don't think anybody's shocked, but you have to ask the question, you know, why have a rule if you're never going to enforce it?
Yeah. It was probably, what, half an hour after the game was over that they actually said, no, he's not going to be suspended. I mean, it was so fast. It was ridiculous.
Of course. Because, you know, the Penguins were down 2-0 in the series. Now, if the Penguins were up 2-0 in the series.
That might be.
Let's think about that for a second, because this is the way the NHL, frankly, governs their game. And I hate to, you know, okay, we're going to create competitive balance, and later we're going to talk about Commissioner Bettman's State of the State address, the State of the League address, and he brings up, that's the one thing he really brought up was, you know, how we have such great competitive balance now and everything else. If that were the case, Gary, then why is it that anybody with a pulse could have figured out that the Red Wings were going to stomp whoever it was that came out of the Eastern Conference? Without even, if we have such great competitive balance, why does the East suck so bad?
And if we have such great competitive balance, why are we looking at the exact same two teams as last season in the Stanley Cup Finals? How is that competitive balance exactly?
I haven't been able to quite figure that out yet. Yeah. Since, you know, I mean, if you look at the Penguins, it's an amazing thing. They have got what, 4 or 5 top 5 picks, or at least 2, or they got Crosby and Fleury are both number 1.
Right.
Overall,
Malkin, I think, was second.
He's second. Saul was a top 5 pick at the 3 or 4. I mean, it you know, yeah, okay. It's a great competitive balance.
It's going to take a while for, you know, our favorite thing, the law of averages, to kind of work themselves out. It happens over the course of a season, obviously, but for a CBA and for stuff like, you know, for the salary cap era and as short, obviously, it was going to be that high priced talent was going to be even higher priced for a little bit in the unrestricted free agent signings, stuff like that. I think it's going to come down to earth eventually, but it's pretty amazing that the people who have had those high draft picks are the ones who are back in the finals again. You know,
it's no one other than don't get me wrong. I mean, the Penguins, you know, have handled that talent well, unlike other teams that have, you know, consistently drafted in the top 5 or top 10, cough Atlanta. But, you know, at the same time, though, I mean, you're talking about at least, you have to say, at least 2 of those players are close to what you'd call generational talents. I mean, Malkin and Crosby, you know, they're going to make the playoffs with those two guys, regardless of what happens with the rest of the team, because those two guys can pretty much, you know, win 30 games on their own.
I mean,
realistically speaking, they create such havoc for everybody around them and make everybody around them so much better that you have two offensive lines on Pittsburgh that will get you past, you know, at least half of the Eastern Conference every season.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, let's face it, let's look at the bottom half of the East. All they have to do is show up against half of the Eastern Conference, and they're going to win, you know, 25-30. And so they really, you know, it's not rocket science. I'm not trying to take anything away from, you know, the calls that Ray Shiro's made at the deadline the last couple of seasons in order to get the team to into a state that it could actually challenge for the Stanley Cup. And, you know, I'm not taking anything away from that. But, you know, there's a part of me that's just, I mean, maybe I'm just tired of the Bettman speak. And it's just, you know, we don't have great competitive balance. Phoenix has sucked for a long time. Atlanta has blown for a long time.
Florida, how could they possibly choke the way they did? And you know, and that's competitive balance. Here we go again with Florida. Well, here we go again with Atlanta. The fact that the Columbus Blue Jackets, I mean, they finally got themselves, I thought they got themselves a pretty decent team together. And, you know, they get swept again, or they get swept out of the first time in the playoffs. It's like,
it's like everything else. There's more to, you know, competitive balance than just you know, giving the right players out and the salary cap and all of this stuff. There's so much to player development. And speaking of Florida, Jacques Martin stepped down as GM of the Florida Panthers, thank God, and is now going to be the coach of the Montreal Canadiens, which was announced today. I saw it on TSN, which, you know, that I think in and of itself should be a positive for the Florida Panthers if they put somebody in place to who can actually assess talent as opposed to coach it. And I think that was the point that Wyshynski was trying to make today on Puck Daddy, which was, you know, quite the good read, by the way. You really let Martin have it over his personnel choices. But again, like everything else, remember, you keep bringing it back up. You know, they had dual affiliation at the AHL level with Buffalo and Rochester for, you know, three seasons, and it really hurt the development of their players.
Absolutely. Yeah, Fanhouse had a live chat today, and somebody said, is there anybody who develops the young talent better than the Detroit Red Wings? And if this were the lockout year, I would say absolutely better. You know, better was the Carolina Hurricanes, who benefited from having their best players in their cup run, their best young players staying in Lowell for one solid year more. And working hard, and that's what happened. Eric Staal came out of that. Cole came out of that. Even Mike Comdor came out of that. Yeah, you know, that's right. That was so. Today, maybe not, but that really should have shown how much people, you know, how important the AHL and the development is right there.
No, absolutely, I completely agree. And Carolina wasn't the only team that went through that. The Sabres benefited a lot. Edmonton benefited from that. Many of the teams benefited from that. And it really helped change the landscape for at least a couple of seasons. It helped the Ducks as well. I mean, you know, there's a lot of the guys that helped the Ducks win the year after Carolina. Why? Because their AHL team was well seasoned. You know, they got a lot of seasoning down in Portland. They won a Calder Cup down in Portland, Kevin Dineen, as the coach. So, yeah, you must take the AHL seriously. We've been saying it all season long. And this job at all levels of the organization. Bettman brought them up as an example of a team that they had to help 20 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, that the Red Wings were, you know, they couldn't get people in the building while they were raffling away cars every night, which is the example he was giving. And, you know, they got good ownership in. The ownership has put the money and the work and put together and built a brilliant organization. And they deserve, you know, they deserve all the accolades and success. I mean, we have to hold them up as the example of how to run a hockey team.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Problem is, I don't think you can get 30 ownership groups that can do that. That's the problem.
Not at all. And also, what are you dealing with? I mean, like, let's say we're talking about the sale in Phoenix. We're not just talking about a team that's starting from scratch. We're also talking about the sins of the past ownership, you know, and tying themselves into jobbing.com arena for as long as they have is, you know, and that these kinds of decisions are going to have repercussions for years and years and years. Stepping into that sort of thing without the protection of a bankruptcy court and things and the like, and maybe getting a few concessions here and there, it's a tall order to ask of someone.
No, it is, and it's going to be extremely difficult to fix the situation in Phoenix. And you know, Bettman talked about it in that address at length about how he thinks that it's possible that hockey can work down there in the city of Glendale and they can make it work. With the right owner, with this, with that. There's an awful lot of ifs there. There's an awful lot of contingencies upon that. Right. You know, upon that affirmation that, hockey can work. I just don't, me personally, I don't see that happening given what we're looking at coming down the pike. But back to something else, that it's as much, you've got to come up with, do you really think, honestly, this is a good question to ask, do you really think that there are 30 good ownership groups plus hockey men to be general managers and head of scouting and everything else, that you really think that there are 30 men capable of running those 30 organizations really competitively? It's a good question to ask.
It is a good question. I think that if I were to just jump into an answer, I would say yes somewhere. I mean, but not in the closed system that we're looking at right now. You know, like considering what Balsillie said about that there is no front door for ownership. And, you know, the fact that even though Gary Bettman says, I don't have a vote, I don't have a vote, and then he turns around and says, I've talked to everybody and, you know, all the owners. Obviously, he has influence, you know, yeah. He obviously has influence even though he doesn't have a vote. So if I would think that, yes, there are those people out there that can make hockey work. And, you know, who thought that hockey would work in Dallas? Who thought that going from Minnesota to Dallas was a good idea at all? Well, losing a franchise in Minnesota wasn't a good idea, but putting one in Dallas, it's turned out not to be a bad one.
Oh, no. I guess you're kind of – I don't say you're wrong about that, and that's true. I mean, who thought hockey could work in Dallas? Obviously, Tom Hicks.
Yeah.
But, you know, who also is now looking to get out. Okay, he wants to get out of, but he just wants to get out of owning sports teams in general. He can see the writing on the wall that these are not, that their current business models are not going to be profitable going forward as a forward going concern, and you know, so given that and given a potentially shrinking environment, and you know, kudos to the NHL for coming up with keep their revenue flat for this year, and given everything that's happened, that's actually really, it is really impressive. But given the extreme, the growing pressures economically that the league is going to face, you now have to really think in terms of how many people are going to be capable of running teams well in that environment. They've been inculcated in the free money bubble environment. So I don't know, and I find the prospect of being able to say yes or no to that question of are there 30 good ownership groups plus management groups out there? I don't know. I really don't think there are. I think there's actually a handful. I think there's 6 to 10.
Would you consider? I mean, obviously it's untested at this point, but would you consider Balsillie one of those in the ownership side? I mean, he is a guy that obviously has the passion.
No, because he's never run a hockey team.
Right.
I think that of the current ownership groups, I think there's maybe six, I can probably count maybe 6 to 10 teams that I think that are really well run, both from an ownership standpoint and from the people that they've hired to run the teams.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, so, and that's, but that changes. It almost changes every year. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in Columbus, I thought the team was horribly misrun. Right. Mm-hmm. Then they fire Doug McClain. They bring in Scott Housen. He hires Ken Hitchcock, and now you've got a good GM with a good coach and a good scouting staff, and a good and you know Hitchcock's done a good job in building up that, and they've done a good job of rebuilding an already young franchise. They've already had to go through a rebuilding effectively. It's crazy, but that's what I would you know I think Columbus has got a shot, and ownership is you know hopefully is going to be committed to. Making you know, giving these guys their head to run the team properly. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Red Wings. Obviously, you know, I think at this point, I think Boston's getting close to getting their house in order.
Right.
You know, for all the crap that they take, I think the Sabres are really well run. Mm-hmm. Just they're a tough market.
Yeah, and it's amazing how fast it can turn around. I mean, I look at the Avalanche 5 years ago, and you know, what were we looking at? We were looking at a huge team. And mind you, and a GM that also got lucky in certain times along the way.
Well,
that's how I look at Columbus too. Is that their dollars and their donuts lined up at exactly the right time to be able to bring in talent when they needed it to, and when the talent was out there at the right price, that their salary cap situation was eased up enough and things like that. You know, it's
well. I think Colorado may be an example of the team, an organization that hasn't adjusted yet to the changing economics.
Yeah.
To the change, you know, not just the salary cap, not just the new CBA, but to, you know, what happens when you're not winning.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how do you rebuild that? And how do you, you know, so the team, effectively, they hollowed that team out. Over the course of the last five or six years, because it was okay to just spend money when you know and live off of your past scouting successes, Mm-hmm. Right. So you had Sakic and you had Forsberg and you had Foot, and then you bring in over the course of time Drury and Hajduk and Tanguay and right? Mm-hmm. And those guys, you know, help, you know, effectively, and then you could fill in with free agents spending as freely as you wanted because you had all the money in the world. But, you know, if you're not bringing, if you're not still spending all that same money and time and energy on the scouting in the AHL, then effectively, you know, every time you bring in another free agent and you trade away a draft pick, you've hollowed the team out.
Absolutely, and they're paying for that now.
Right, and they're going to pay for that for the next 3 or 4 years, and no amount of money, especially in the salary cap era, is going to change that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the, now the question is, what was a model franchise or what was a well-run franchise?
Mm-hmm.
Is no longer.
Well, and also I think what was, and this is somewhat speculation in a way, but what was somewhat of a, of an, you know, having a little bit of honor. We hear about one of the things with the Red Wings. I mean, Detroit, as far as Detroit the city is pretty much is crappy. I mean, I was there a year and a half ago for 5-6 weeks, and they're on, I mean, it's getting better. Don't get me wrong, it's getting better, but Detroit is not a pleasant place to be, to live, to any of it. That I, you know, and I'm sorry, people who love to be in Detroit, but that's just my perspective from actually being there. Also, it's not just reading a media report; it's actually being there. But the players want to come play for Detroit because they like how the franchise is run. They like how the right. how the organization is run. And that used to be, I think, more the case with the Avalanche also. And looking at what happened with the Patrick Waugh coaching GM situation, it doesn't seem to be that way. Patrick Waugh finally, admitting finally that he got offered the coaching position or the GM position. He didn't really say which one he was, you know, but he turned down the Avalanche. Any of their offers, and yet here we are with Tony Granato still as the coach, and everybody wondering, you know, kind of looking at him as, you know, the guy who got ditched at the dance. What happened? And he doesn't really necessarily know. I mean, that's no way to run a business, an organization, or anything.
That's not. I don't think it's good people management skills at all.
No, and but, this wasn't always the case. I mean, Colorado was a place that people wanted to play. It was, it wasn't just it was the possibility of a cup and also the organization itself that made the bus that was Solani in Korea come along.
Right,
and you know, I also look at in the minor league perspective. There's the Colorado Eagles of the Central Hockey League when Professional Hockey Players Association started working on becoming the union of the Central Hockey League. All eyes were on Colorado and saying, if all teams were run like the Colorado Eagles are run, we wouldn't need a players union. Mm. And it spoke to how the kind of talent that the team was able to bring in because there was so much outside of just the team itself. The team treated the players well.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and it's funny, you know, you talk about that portion of it, and let's, you know, you've got your team, and your team has gone through this change in perspective, and then there's the other side of it. It is my team, which has actually had to work really, really hard to overcome the stigma of being a bad place to play,
mm-hmm.
Most of because of the way the end of the Regas reign of terror ended, the bankruptcy and everything else, people not getting paid, and, you know, and Regier having to make really horrible choices and whatnot. And then, you know, and then realistically after that, having to say, well, we can't afford to keep this one versus that one. We're, you know, no matter, we're going to be damned if we do, damned if we don't, no matter what, you know, choice we make. But as far as being able to recruit free agent talent or keep people keep people happy once they've been traded and brought to Buffalo, that everybody says the same thing when they get there. Wow, I didn't realize how great it was to play here. Mm-hmm. It's different, you know, when you drive, when you come in and you're an out of towner, they all say the same thing, you know, and which is that you come in, you fly in, the place is horrible, you play the game and you leave and you say, I'd never want to play here. And then they actually come and they love it. Mm-hmm. The cost of living is low. There's all these advantages. They're, you know, respected within the community. Everybody knows who they are. It's a small town with a big attitude. That kind of thing. I've heard that so many different times. I've heard it from Craig Revey. I've heard it from Yara Spacek. I've heard it from all of these guys as they've come in. So, and the Sabres themselves as an organization has worked really hard to try and, you know, try and improve their image regardless of everything that happened with Drury and Briere and Campbell and everybody else. Mm-hmm. So, you know. And
well, the intangibles that are going to start, you know, bringing right. players along. And I mean, it was that kind of intangible that basically made Hossa sign with the Red Wings in a way.
Right.
It's I mean, obviously the talent that was there in the cup and all of that, it obviously wasn't about the money because he got better offers for longer term sure. at other places that were fine places to play. But the intangibles are what made him say, I will do this.
And a powerful motivator, and I think it was a powerful message he sent, and frankly it's a good one. Mm-hmm. Which is, I want to go play for somebody who's going to give me a shot at what I want, which is more than just money,
right?
And we all ask that, you know, at some level every fan asks that their sports heroes do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't blame them for chasing the money, but at the same time we'd like to see them, you know, really show us that they do care about something other than just the money.
And hopefully things like that are going to bring the average mean of that free agent market within the salary cap era down a little bit. I mean, in a couple of years, a couple of people do that, and maybe the value of a high-priced free agent starts to drop a little bit to a more reasonable area, and GMs aren't basically the same gun that was held to their head before isn't still being held to it.
Well, and you could also look at it this way, that it's like everything else, the market corrects. Mm-hmm. You can look at it this way, that, you know, the teams ultimately, not only within the salary cap, but just in general, if you want to attract top-tier talent, you have to eventually give them a good place to work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if they're union, the non-union, it doesn't matter. The Detroit Red Wings are showing you what you need to do in order to attract the top talent and go there and play. And there's, you know, it's more than just the money. And some places all they have is the money because they have nothing else. And other teams have, you know, they have other intangibles. So you have those other factors, and you can weigh all that you know, weigh all those things. And it just puts pressure on the teams to be better employers, mm-hmm. which is a good thing. Which yeah. is all it's all we ever ask of the owners. We only ever ask that the owners treat the players well, and we only ask that the players take us into consideration when they make their decisions mm-hmm. as best they can, ultimately, you know, and we start to see a shift of that a little bit in each direction over the course of time. I think it'll be a good thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. Part of the thing with the salary cap was that cost certainty. And unfortunately they instituted it right at the time when, you know, free agent prices were at all time high. So that correction needs to happen. I think it needs to happen sooner rather than later. And until that happens, there will finally maybe be a little bit of cost certainty. But
It will, because the cost certainty is built into the escrow system, into the salary system. So regardless of anything else, what's going to happen is that you saw a lot of these free agent prices going up year over year because the cap kept going up at double-digit inflation. There was double-digit inflation in the NHL year over year for the first 3 years of the cap. We're not going to have that anymore. So now we're going to watch the inevitable contraction happen. Thankfully, and this is a good thing from the NHL's perspective. It's a good thing from a lot of people's perspective. This way, the system will help cushion the blow in both directions. Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be, you know, the players all know what they got into. And at the end of the day, as they watch revenues, you know, if revenues shrink next year by 15-20%, okay, and their salaries shrink by 15-20%, at least they still have jobs.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be really obvious to a lot of people that's going to be important. I think it'll actually penetrate the brains of the players. It's, look, you know, the people out there who are cheering us on, who still has a job left?
Yeah.
You know, okay, so we had to take a 15% pay cut. The league could have contracted by six teams, and then four guys that are sitting next to me on the bench wouldn't have jobs.
Right. No, I agree. I agree. It's, yeah. It's hopefully they'll keep that perspective. I know that, you know, one of the things that you always hear about when any sports person goes to the, you know, goes to the majors, you know, gets the call, is that they don't have to carry their bag anymore, you know, and right. hopefully right. some of those guys will remember that that was quite a perk in the first place.
That's right.
I guess it's good timing to talk about the rest of, or at least some of the other parts of his Bettman State of the State address. Mm-hmm. You were mentioning before we started recording about the TV ratings and what you were seeing there, and how good it looks, actually.
Yeah, well, Bettman noted that the TV ratings were up on all the networks, that even the CBC ratings were up, I think, by 5%. And the Versus' ratings were up significantly, nearly 25% or something. I think that's what Bettman said, which is a good sign. It's a good sign that and that the Stanley Cup playoffs, Stanley Cup finals, first two games had overnight ratings that had audiences that were bigger than they've been since 2002. That's a great sign for the league. Mm-hmm. And that their gamble or strategy to have the first two games of the finals be on NBC and be on the weekend seems to have paid off. Mm, it got the CBC what they wanted, got Hockey Night in Canada, got game one on a Saturday on their traditional Saturday night, you know, broadcast at 7 p.m. I think that's 8 p.m. I think that's great. And now they get to take games 3 and 4 back into Versus. Now, it would have been nice had the Penguins won one of the two games. I think it would have created a little bit more excitement. Personally, I could care less. I think I'd almost like to watch grass grow than watch the Red Wings win another Stanley Cup. But, you know, that's just personal opinion.
Yeah. It would be nice to see a little more competition. But being able to see the games, I think, is just as important. And, you know, I think it was pretty funny when Chris Osgood was asked if he had seen any of the games on his off days. And he said, you know what, I can't, because a lot of the hotels that we get when we're on the road don't have Versus.
I saw that quote and I was like, oh my God, we just don't, you know. And there's, you know, there's the NHL just going through their adolescent.
Yeah, it's cringing.
Yeah, but it's fine. It's actually kind of funny, I think.
If Chris Osgood can't watch the games, then we need the hockey back on ESPN.
Yeah, just hear it now. And close Florida now while you're at it and bring everybody back to Canada.
I was laughing when I saw that.
Yeah, so was I.
Go team NHL. Jeez.
That's okay. There's nothing wrong with having a little dissension in the ranks. It's actually a good thing. Hockey players speak their mind and they should. So we need more of that. If anything, they've vanilla the players down too much and not let their personality shine through.
Yeah.
It's hard enough when they're in body armor and helmets and everything else, and you can't even see who they are anymore. So, you know, it's hard enough. I mean, you know, I don't watch baseball, but I can look up at ESPN, and when I see, and I know who Manny Ramirez is. You know, I just look up and go, there's the fat guy with the hair streaming. I'm like, there's Manny Ramirez. Can't
miss
him.
Looks kind of like the guy from Predator.
Yeah, never watched a game in which never watched Manny Ramirez play baseball live, but I know exactly who he is. Now, you know, how many casual hockey fans or non-hockey fans know Sidney Crosby by looking at him, or Alexander Ovechkin by just the way he skates?
Right.
Not many.
No. And that's hockey. That's visors. That's helmets. That's, yeah. You know, if it weren't for the marketing machine of the NFL, you wouldn't know what Tom Brady looked like. You wouldn't know you know, half these guys look like. But, I mean, Brett Favre I could pick out on a street no problem for just because of the marketing. So.
That's because he has more gray hair in his beard than I have.
That's saying something, isn't it?
Yeah, it is actually saying a lot. No, I just – there's a part of me that remembers when I was, you know, 12, 13, or, you know, watching the NHL, and there's Ron Duguay flying down the ice, hair streaming, same thing with Guy Lafleur. And it's just, you know, I see those old – and I just, you know, it's just – it's part of me still wishes that was possible.
Oh yeah,
because it would just be great, but it's not. So
no, it's not. It's never going to be that again. I mean, I go when I go skate, even public skate, I wear my hockey gloves because it's just plain safer. You know, if I'm going to fall, at least I have some protection. So the way that these guys are banging around, can you imagine if they took off the helmets? I mean, it's one of the things that bugs the crap out of me with these with some people when they say you put on the visors and that's when the sticks come up. Well, the sticks aren't going to go down if you ban visors. You know, the speed of the game is so fast. The banging and crashing is so hard. It's, you know, and everybody gets hit when you touch the puck. It's just, it's not taking away equipment is not going to help any of that.
I'm on both sides of the fence about it, frankly. But I can concede the point in some places, and I don't really want to talk. I don't think it's really the time or place to do right. this, but you know, I part of me does think that, you know, hard plastic forearm pads need to go the way of the dodo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to break somebody's jaw with your arm, then you get to break your radius and ulna at the same time.
Oh yeah, it'd be nice.
That's my opinion on this.
In the collateral damage sort of sense, yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I'm with you on that. I just don't think that with the speed of the game, that collateral damage is the only kind of damage that, you know, we need to, you know, concern ourselves with. That these guys are going 35 miles an hour on their skates. They're sprinting out there. And back in the day when it was a 2-minute shift rather than a 45-second shift, sure, right. You know, you're never going to quite get up to that speed because you do have to pace yourself. These guys don't have to pace themselves anymore. So
it'll be interesting to see what happens if there's a really big correction in the revenue generated by professional sports. I mean, what I mean by a really big correction, I mean 75-80% drop in revenue.
Mm.
And if that's the case, I wonder just how many of these professional athletes are going to spend so much of their lives to, you know, because you have to think in terms of their conditioning and their regimen and everything else is based on the idea of getting to the NHL to get the big payout, or the NBA to get the big payout, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you know, and the professional athlete has become different, and it's you know, he's become bigger and stronger and faster and everything else because the potential payoff is that much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reward is that much bigger. So I wonder if there was it's an intellectual exercise, because I don't think that kind of correction is coming, but you know, if there was a 75% drop in revenue in the NHL and it went back to being effectively a $500 million business year round, mm-hmm. you know, of the, say, of the level of the AHL or the, you know, or even lower, would they still train their entire lives and spend 24 hours a day being a professional hockey player, or would it be more of a beer league sort of thing and guys smoking on the bench between shifts and, you know, having beers between periods and then go out and playing again? You know what I mean? I wonder if you know, they would take it all so seriously, and that would then, you know, bring their bodies back down to the amount of contact and everything else back down to more human levels.
I don't know. I wonder if they would, because what we're looking at also is guys who are committed to the sport itself, and at the same time, it's just like everywhere else, there's more competition for everything, and, you know, there's, everybody is working a little bit harder to make sure that they're staying ahead of that curve, even to earn their you know, even the meager paychecks. And I mean, like, looking at the newspaper industry, they're still scrambling to catch up to the bloggers, you know, and
the newspaper industry is dead because they made serious design decisions or business decisions 5 years ago.
Yeah, and you that's know Craigslist problem. Doesn't tell. They're still catching up to Craigslist too, and they're never going
to
do it.
The RIA is still catching up to the concept of CDs and MP3s. I mean,
absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
So, you know, I don't want to get off onto an IP rant, because that's a completely different issue.
No, I'm just saying that it, you know, people are, you know, the competition is still out there, and it's even more.
Oh, of course.
You know, it's even more fierce, even at the lower levels, than it used to be in just about anything. So, but yeah, you're right. If the money wasn't there, would people scramble as much? Probably not. But at the same time, you might introduce another element that these, you know, the way that we are these days, of more headhunting, not less, because, you know,
there'd be more fighting.
Yeah, you introduce a different
element. They'd just be more fighting. There would just be a lot more guys bruising each other up with, you know, with beer bellies, and as opposed to six packs. The six packs would be in their hands, not in their stomachs. Nice. And it'd be kind of awesome, actually.
See them start throwing bottles at each other's benches. That'd be fun.
It'd be kind of cool in its own way, because that would be all-time hockey.
We have, real fast, we have two quick stories that are pretty much non-stories. The Kostitsyn brothers were cleared of any wrongdoing. Whoop-de-doo.
Brothers Karamazov? I'm sorry.
you know,
I think my literary reference in for the week. Stop.
100 years of, you know, whatever for the Montreal Canadiens,
exactly.
All culminating in the Costitsyn brothers being cleared and Jacques Martin being the new head coach. Congratulations, Montreal Canadiens. The other story being that the other story that's not really a story is the Washington Capitals, between the last time you and I talked, have been quote unquote implicated in a steroid scandal that essentially amounts to some people who are busted for selling steroids illegally mentioned the Capitals and the Washington Nationals as two teams that they were supplying for. So wild speculation turns into an investigation, and so far it's much ado about nothing.
Yay. I think you know my opinion on this. If the guys want to take steroids and that's what they want to do, they can do it. I don't hold any illusions about my professional athletes being my heroes or anything, so I can care less.
So, the only other story after that is just that there is the real news, I guess. The other real news in personnel is that Joe Nieuwendyk is going to be the GM of the Stars. So right. That moves Brett Hull back to being pretty much ambassador of fun and Les Jackson blowing up balloons for the kids.
That's about where he belongs.
Yeah, and this looks great for me. I think this is wonderful. Who knows what Nieuwendyk's going to bring, but that there at least is a little bit more accountability for what happened in the season. And this odd two-headed monster that they were trying to go with, just basically they can admit, hey, this didn't work out, and we're going to do something else.
You know, I don't know Joe Nieuwendyk at all. I've seen him play. I've watched him interviewed. You know, I mean, in a sense, he looks like GM material to me. Mm. You know, he has he just seems like he has that kind of personality. He just looks like executive material to me, I'm going to say I would think a good judge of he's a good hockey guy. He's impeccable credentials on the ice, and I have always looked to me like a player's coach, like half player, half coach in that sense. I always look like that kind of guy. So it'll be interesting to see if it works out. If it does, then it means that Tom Hicks is still serious about fielding a good team down in Dallas, even though he obviously has made. You know, he's made it public that he's looking to sell out and get out of the professional sports business. It's a good thing that he's not, you know, trying to. He's at the least.
He's not gutting the team like the Nationals.
No, he's not gutting the team. Thank you. Yeah. He's not gutting the team on his way out the door or anything along those lines. Where he looks for new ownership or anything like that. And honestly, had Dallas not gotten completely decimated by injuries to their top players during the season, they would have made the playoff mix. They would have made some noise.
Oh, yeah.
The Western Conference.
No, I think this is a great thing that they're actually like kind of correcting the situation before any kind of a sale. You know, it is the exact opposite of what Leopold did before leaving the Predators, which was trying to add by subtracting and gutting the payroll and also the talent, and so making I think this kind of makes it a lot more attractive without having to change the players on the ice at this point.
Right. I don't think there's much that Dallas really has to do other than stay healthy and to be competitive.
Yeah.
And that's, you know,
unless you ask the Stars fans and then they have to get rid of Turco too. But I don't buy into that at all. Considering what the Avalanche have had for the last couple of years, I'd take Turco in a heartbeat.
Well, and also you have to remember that you're talking about a fan base with extremely high expectations, extremely high standards. And because of that, it's taken, you know, Marty Turco isn't Eddie Belfour at his height, you know, get over it. But he's still a fine goaltender. Mm-hmm. And the minute they got rid of Sean Avery, his numbers went through the roof.
Yeah.
I didn't have any problem with Marty Turco at that point. After they got rid of Avery, they were healthy for a while. He was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And then the team fell apart after, you know, Brad Richards broke his like twice. So, you know, some seasons you just have to chalk up to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just the lost season. And, we'll bring Ray Milland out of the closet and that'll be that. But I mean, it is what it is. And I don't think there's anything for the fans in Dallas to worry about other than the fact that they, you know, Do they have questions about whether Turco's capable of winning a Stanley Cup? Sure. Getting back to the playoffs and re-solidifying their fan base and competing in the Western Conference with the best teams, I don't think that's much for an issue.
Mm-hmm. No, I think Turco's completely capable of winning the Stanley Cup. I mean, it's kind of funny considering that, you know, he goes through he's had very little success in the playoffs, but you know, so has Roberto Luongo, but nobody questions Roberto Luongo. Well, at least until this season.
Well,
so
I don't think that's quite the fair comparison. I think the better comparison would actually be Eddie Belfour before he won a cup in '99. Mm. And now, and because I mean, Luongo really hasn't played on, never had any good. This is the first good team he had in front of him, and then Luongo has not been the problem, other than the last couple of games against Chicago this year in Vancouver. He's been just fine. I think Turco has folded under pressure in his early playoff experiences, but he's improved just about every season that he's gone into the playoffs. He's improved.
Oh, yeah.
Each year that he's been in the playoffs. So I don't think that – I think that he's just one of these guys that's – I don't know. It's very possible that he's just, in that respect, just a late bloomer. Mm-hmm. And he may have two or three really good playoff runs left in him.
Well, Dallas lost to Detroit?
Yeah.
And there's nothing to sneeze about there. I mean, considering
I don't think it was Turco's fault, if memory serves. So.
No, it wasn't. And then the previous year, I believe they were eliminated by the Vancouver Canucks, and they were extremely low-scoring games.
Oh, yeah. No, those games were 1-0, 2-1. Marty Turco was not the problem. I think that was the year that he finally that's the year that he finally played like he did, you know, when he was at Michigan State, right?
Mm-hmm.
Michigan State or Michigan that he played at. Well, that gamer goaltender that he was when he was in college, and that, you know, came out of college with all the accolades and everything else, and everybody said, you know, this guy's a winner, and every, you know, and he finally rose to that challenge. And I thought that first round series he played against Vancouver a couple of years ago was a harbinger of things to come than.
Oh, absolutely. People were saying that it should have been the series, basically, that even though he lost, you know, that the Stars were eliminated, that made people question, you know, or stop questioning whether or not he could actually be a playoff goaltender. And that one proved that, yes, he could.
Mm-hmm.
And the only unfortunate part about it was that he was eliminated. And then the next round, you know, the next season, well, they... You know, they go a lot deeper, play a lot better.
And they lose to the Cup champions.
Yeah. Who were on just absolutely on a mission. And right. So it's, you know, it's hard to discount Marty Turco these days, at least in my opinion.
Nah, I don't think it's going to be an issue. I think Dallas will be fine this year, and the Western Conference will be, we'll see how things work out. I don't think they'll have any problem competing out the Pacific
Division. I hope it's more competitive. It'd be real nice.
Would be.
All right. Well, Tom, thanks a lot. A whole lot of news this week, and hopefully we'll see some more next week, other than just who's going to win the Stanley Cup.
Yeah, and you and I are going to have to start boning up on our salary cap positions on all the teams, because we're going to get rapidly into draft day, and we're going to have to start putting on our amateur GM caps
and free agency right after that.
Exactly.
So. All right. Great. Thank you so much, Tom.
No problem, James. Take care.
Thanks a lot for listening to The Rink. The Rink, as always, can be found at www.rinkpodcast.com, where you can find our Twitter feed, subscribe to us on iTunes, or leave comments about anything you heard here. What, you never call? You never write? Well, if you want to call or write, the email is rink@rinkpodcast.com, and the phone number is 845-704-RINK. That's 845-704-7465. Thanks for listening to The Rink.